As the year comes to a close, we're taking a look back at the biggest Florida news stories of 2017. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. Massive hurricanes, corrupt politicians, and the tragic death of a famous manatee. No, it's not a new Carl Hiaasen book. On this month's Reporters Roundtable, we're taking stock of 2017 and discussing the state's biggest news stories. Here in the studio with me is Steve Newborn, a reporter and assistant news director at WUSF, and Zach Anderson, political editor at the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Glad to be here.
Well, my vote for the biggest story of the year, because it affected nearly everybody in the state, has to be Hurricane Irma. So how would you sum up the economic and the emotional impact that that storm had on our state?
I totally agree with you, Robin, that I think that that was definitely the biggest story of the year. I mean, it was a huge buildup a couple weeks ahead of time where we see this storm coming across the Atlantic Ocean. And I think it built up a lot of anxiety in all of us. I think at one point it was measured as the strongest storm on record, I think, in the Atlantic Basin. The governor was out on TV the whole time trying to get people to evacuate. I think it was the largest evacuation in Florida history and one of the largest evacuations in the history of the country for a mass disaster.
And then we were hearing people were going too far. They shouldn't have gone so far.
Right.
They were running out of gas. And then, oh, it's going to hit Tampa. Now they need to go back to Miami. There was a lot of confusion, right?
There was, and there was concerns about there wasn't going to be enough gas, that hotel rooms were going to be overbooked, but it looked like they were able to get the logistics right, and people were able to get the gas and get out and get to a safe place. You know, the aftermath of the storm was, I think for most people, at least in our area, the Tampa area, the Sarasota area, we feel like we really dodged a bullet. Obviously down in Key West and Marco Island, it was a much different story. I mean, I think the Keys, something like half of the buildings or more were damaged. So it was a pretty big impact for some areas.
Yes, Steve.
Yeah, I can speak to that personally. I went down to Key West for Thanksgiving and driving through on the overseas highway, driving through Big Pine Key and Cudjoe Key and the Middle Keys there, there was just utter devastation. This is 2 months after the storm and some of the trees didn't have leaves.
Wow.
And still huge mounds of debris on the side of the highway they're going in. But I think one of the legacies we're going to see from Hurricane Irma is what Zach was talking about, gasoline.
Yeah.
We all heard about the massive traffic jams on I-75 going into Georgia. So one of the things that the legislature is talking about now for the upcoming year is to mandate some kind of farms, petroleum farms, gasoline farms, so there will be an emergency supply. So when the storm's coming, the ports have to close a couple of days in advance so the ships coming in can't get there. So we'll have a ready supply on hand. So maybe that's one of the legacies.
Sounds like a
we'll
good
see.
Idea. Yeah. And, you know, things are just starting to get rebuilt now. I mean, the effects of Hurricane Irma are, a lot of them are just now being felt because people's insurance claims are now being denied or accepted. So now they can start paying out the construction. It seems like there's a lot of construction that's going on now. I heard someone I know talk about they own a fencing company and they're booked out through, you know, they're making appointments for February.
Yeah.
So now is when people are trying to rebuild.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing where, you know, one of the biggest damages that people had, you know, there was a lot of trees down. It wasn't a lot of buildings that were destroyed unless you were in the Keys or down in Marco Island, but there was a lot of trees down, a lot of fences destroyed, a lot of pool cages destroyed. And I think for fencing, pool cage companies, mm-hmm. that they're booked out for months, if not years, for some of these repairs. But, you know, for the most part, I think that we're seeing things pretty much get back to normal. I mean,
the debris's gone.
Yeah, the
much.
Debris is gone. Mm-hmm. And it took a while. Down where I am in Sarasota County, we had a lot of tree branches down and just in my yard, and we piled it up by the side of the road. And I want to say it took almost 2 months for the debris to get cleared. And that was another big story from the storm where some of the debris contractors were not honoring their contracts and they were going for their south where they could make more money. So there were some governments, Sarasota County was one of them, where they didn't have enough people to pick up the debris right away, and it took quite a long time to get it off the side of the road. I think most people were willing to accept that. You know, if that's the worst thing that happened, you just have a big mound of sticks and branches in front of your house, that's probably not the worst thing that could happen. The power outages, though, I think those were fairly significant for people. Even though you talk to people and you talk to FPL and they say their power restoration effort was much faster than it was after something like Wilma, and that, you know, they asked people to please be patient because this affected the whole state and they had to get crews from all over the country. If you were without power for a few days, or, you know, for some people it was a week or more.
9 days in my case.
Yeah, nine days.
Very stressful.
Wow, it is very stressful.
It is stressful. Yeah. And another story that spun off from Hurricane Irma was its effect on citrus. Now, you know, citrus has just been limping along as it is. Citrus production is down 70% from what it was a decade ago. And now here comes Hurricane Irma and cuts that production by half.
It's hard to overstate the sort of dire state that the citrus industry is in Florida. They're talking about the worst harvest in like half a century or more. The number of boxes is down dramatically, and that's piled on top of the citrus greening and all the other diseases that they've had. The hurricane knocked a lot of the fruit off just when it was ripe and ready to harvest. And so there's been a big effort to try and provide some relief to the citrus industry, and there was
federal disaster relief.
Yeah, money. And I think there was an announcement just recently that some money had been included in the federal disaster aid, and maybe some tax breaks that look like they're going to pass Congress here. So there is some relief coming for the industry, but it's still a big blow to one of the state's really iconic industries.
Congressman Dennis Ross, whose district includes a lot of Polk County, which has really been the center of citrus for, you know, decades, said this: the effect of Hurricane Irma is like the death knell for citrus. Mm. On top of the greening and the canker and everything else out there, some of these grove owners aren't going to make it. So he's been lobbying Congress to get some money included, you know, relief bill. But another person who's using that as kind of campaign fodder is Adam Putnam, who comes from Bartow and is a scion of a longtime citrus family. You know, this is going to come up in his campaign. One of his angles is going to be pushing for citrus mm-hmm. relief.
And we're going to be getting to that story of the gubernatorial campaign in just a moment. But first, I want to get to a story that I feel like may have been underreported somewhat, and that is the conviction of former United States Representative Corrine Brown for basically using a fake charity as a slush fund. Can you explain about that story, Zach?
Yeah, Corrine Brown is a longtime U.S. congresswoman from the Jacksonville area. I think she originally, her district stretched all the way down to Orlando, and then it was redrawn. But yeah, she's been in Congress for quite a long time and sort of an icon in the African-American community. And so she, you know, had a lot of stature. And so to have her, you know, be brought down by something like this did send some shockwaves through Florida politics, especially Jacksonville politics. So she, like you said, was accused of using this charity to personally.
And convicted.
Yeah,
One
accused and convicted.
One door for education.
Right, right, which is particularly egregious. Mm-hmm. You know, money that is supposed to be going to help education, going to benefit yourself, I think.
And things like a $7,000 penthouse to go watch a Jaguar game in North Carolina.
It really plays into the worst stereotypes that people have about politics and politicians, that they're all corrupt, they're all out for themselves, that the system is rigged against the average person.
So, Zach, why do you think this didn't get more? I mean, it was not a hard story to understand. It wasn't complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, this money was supposed to be for an educational charity, and they were spending it, she and two assistants were spending it on themselves. Why do you think it didn't get more play?
Well, you know, news organizations don't have the resources that they once did. There's not as many reporters covering state politics as there used to be. But there's also was a lot going on this year, I think, and both in state and national politics. And sometimes things just sort of get overshadowed. Obviously, the president, you know, he takes up a lot of news copy and airtime. And so I think that, you know, you're right. This was a big issue, but it didn't maybe get the coverage that you might see in another
year. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, there's been so many scandals. I mean, it's like kind of a scandal of the
week
here.
Not of congressmen, not of United States congressmen in Florida.
Well, I think it's more than that. It's just high-profile people, celebrities. They kind of suck the oxygen out of the media.
People have scandal weariness, scandal fatigue.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all the Hollywood celebrities and all the politicians getting caught up in the sexual harassment thing, it seems like we're getting numb to it. You know, it's like nothing shocks us anymore because it keeps coming at us in waves. So what is really that shocking anymore about a congresswoman on the take, right? Mm.
You're listening to Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sussingham, and we're taking a look at the year's biggest news stories. We'll take a brief break and be right back. I'm Robin Sussingham, and this is Florida Matters, and we're talking about the biggest Florida news stories of the year. In the studio with me are Steve Newborn, a reporter and assistant news director at WUSF, and Zach Anderson, the political editor at the Sarasota Herald Tribune. So, Steve, as you mentioned earlier, we had the race to the governor's office beginning this year. Has Adam Putnam got this thing wrapped up, do you think?
Well, I think the jury's still out on that. It's funny. I started covering Adam when he was 23, running for state house in Polk County.
I think at the time he was the youngest lawmaker ever elected to the Florida legislature.
Right. Yes. Reporters knew this guy was destined for something more. I mean, we knew he was going to be governor someday. It was kind of preordained. Mm-hmm. And he did the right thing. He did the traditional steps going to Congress and then became agriculture commissioner and so on. So, you know, it is not a done deal at all. He's got some tough competition. Maybe not on the Republican side, but a couple of the Democrats are looking very interesting. Gwen Graham has got the name recognition. Her dad was Bob Graham, former governor and senator. Right off the bat, people know her. She's got kind of a more liberal bent than most politicians that have been elected in Florida. But another interesting guy that's on the Democratic side is Philip Levine, the former mayor of Miami Beach. He's made a name for himself in fighting climate change because of the geography of Miami Beach getting flooded at high tides and everything. He's a self-made millionaire, and he has got a ton of money already in the coffers. So the Democrats are kind of well-positioned here.
And that's interesting. So he's from South Miami Beach, Miami Beach?
Miami Beach, right.
He's from Miami Beach, so he's got name recognition in South Florida, where I feel like Adam Putnam doesn't have it so much. He's a very well-known entity to us in the Tampa Bay area and in Polk County and Central Florida. But I wonder about South Florida.
Yeah, and Robin, that's a good point. You know, oftentimes candidates sort of have their regional bases, and the Tampa media market is very important. It makes up a very large percentage of the total number of votes in the state. But South Florida is even bigger, and so Philip Levine, being from that area, you know, having some name recognition there will help him. Adam Putnam has the advantage of, you know, he's the current agriculture commissioner. He's won office statewide twice, so he is probably better known statewide. He's still not extremely well known, I don't think, but he's probably better known than Philip Levine. It's an interesting governor's race. You know, a Democrat hasn't won a race for governor in Florida since 1994. So it's
been a long
time. And, Republicans have had a pretty tight lock on the governor's mansion since Jeb Bush first won in 1998. This is an unusual political climate. It's probably a favorable political climate for Democrats because there's strong pushback against President Trump. Democrats are energized. But typically in these governor's races, these midterm elections, Democrats don't come out in as big a numbers. And that's one of the big reasons that Republicans have been so successful. But there's an open seat this year. Rick Scott is term limited after 8 years in office. And so the Democrats probably have their best opportunity in a long time because there's an open seat. They're not running against an incumbent. They have a favorable environment for Democrats right now. the biggest issue that they have is none of their candidates are all that well known.
Well, John Morgan was of Morgan and Morgan. I mean, people were thinking, well, he might really have a good chance, and then took himself out of the race.
Yeah, and I think political reporters were kind of hoping that he would get in because he's a very interesting, colorful personality. And people thought that in the era of Donald Trump, he was sort of the Democratic Donald Trump. He was profane.
Would say anything.
Yeah, he would say anything.
So what do Democrats need to do to have a shot at the governor? Governor's office?
I don't know. I don't know if Democrats can win statewide office, to tell you the truth. I mean, their left of center message really doesn't resonate with the majority of people in Florida. Just look at the candidates they've had in the past who look good on paper, but when it comes to the election, they're always 5 to 10 percentage points behind. But like Zach was saying, this is a really good climate for Democrats with an expected wave of resentment, to use a word, against what Donald Trump has wrought in Washington.
The political editors say the Democrats are energized. That's the word you hear a lot.
Right,
They'll turn out, in other words.
So this is going to be a midterm election, and that's going to get more people on the other side of the aisle, more Democrats to the polls next year. So that speaks well for people like Gwen Graham and Philip Levine. They are going to have a lot more of their supporters out there. And Andrew Gillum, too, the mayor of Tallahassee, he's in the race, too. He's had some setbacks.
What about Richard Corcoran? He hasn't declared his
candidacy. And he seems like a very, very likely candidate as well. He's raising a lot of money. He's been attacking Adam Putnam. You know, Richard Corcoran, for those who don't know, he's the Republican state House Speaker. He used to be Marco Rubio's chief of staff when Marco Rubio was the state House Speaker before Marco Rubio became senator. So he's been in Florida politics a long time. He knows the game. He knows how to set himself up. It looks like he's making moves to run for statewide office. He's been taking shots at Adam Putnam, the other Republican who's already announced on Twitter over immigration. It looks like Corcoran would try to run to the right of Putnam and try to challenge him from the conservative side.
So that's a story for next year. I want to change gears here for a second, because another story that dominated headlines this year, Steve, the murders in Seminole Heights that had the neighborhood terrorized. The police think it was all committed by one serial killer who is in custody. Tell us what happened there.
Well, yeah, this has really roiled that neighborhood. The police arrested this man after he made a mistake. Yeah, well, he gave his gun to a coworker. He worked at a McDonald's in Ybor City. He gave his gun to a coworker to hold while they went to Amscot to cash a check. And there, lo and behold, just so happened to be a police officer in the McDonald's. But this was a real lucky break for the police, because I don't think this guy would have been arrested by now, even if he didn't do that. One theory is that he wanted to be arrested, so that's why he did this. But it really has roiled this neighborhood. Seminole Heights is an old working-class neighborhood just north of Tampa's downtown. It was one of the first suburbs of Tampa.
That's where you live.
That's where I live, yeah. Old bungalows from the 1920s, and it's kind of got a nice vibe there. And that vibe was completely demolished by what happened here. I go out walking my dog at night, just for instance, and there used to be people out there all the time saying hi. I walk out there, there's nobody on the road. Absolutely nobody. Mm. And this neighborhood is also full of trendy restaurants, and they were really hurting from this. People would not come into this neighborhood.
It was so random the way they were choosing the victims. There was no rhyme or reason to it. So it made people feel like there's no reason they wouldn't be next.
And it almost seems just of another era. You don't hear so much about serial killers. It almost seems like those were the day 70s, 80s. It's just, you don't really hear about, these modern day serial killers. I think it really shocked people and scared people. Even where I live in Sarasota, people were following this story because it is terrifying to think that there's no rhyme or reason to this. This person is just selecting his victims, who knows how, and that anybody could potentially be a victim.
Well, that's what made everybody scared, is that you don't know who he's going to shoot next.
Did they come up with a motive for this person?
No, not yet. We have no idea what motivated this guy. I mean, the fourth man he shot, Ronald Felton, was opening up a food pantry on Nebraska Avenue, which runs through the heart of the neighborhood, at like 2 in the morning, and he crossed the street for some reason, and he was shot dead right in the middle of Nebraska Avenue, this busy artery. And that scared the heck out of people. They didn't know if they were going to be next.
Right.
But one good thing, if there is a silver lining out of all this, is that it really has had the neighborhood come together. They just recently had a motorcycle rally where they laid wreaths for the victims. They had a Light the Heights event where they asked everybody to put up lights in their home, and it was very well attended.
And also this year, there's really been a sea change in thinking about public monuments to Civil War veterans. There's been a lot of discussion about how to preserve history and honor the dead while respecting the feelings of those who are hurt by what the statues represent. What's been your experience, Zach?
So there was a monument in downtown Bradenton, actually, that there was protests over. Some groups came out to try and get the county commission to remove it. And they did end up voting to remove it, but there were counter protests from people who wanted to keep it. And it was a lot of drama surrounding it. And they decided they were going to move it to, I think there's a plantation that's a state park or a county park. And they broke it while they were moving it. And so there was, you know, it was just an odd story from beginning to end, and a very emotional one. You know,
Campbell Plantation.
Yes, exactly. Some people really view this as part of their history. Others view it as offensive and symbolic of an era when, you know, obviously people were very oppressed based on their race. So, you know, it's not one of those issues where there's an easy kind of solution to it. I think there's
not an easy fix.
And it really was stoked when there was the protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, over a statue of Confederate
General
Robert E. Lee.
That got people thinking about it and voting on it.
The president's response to that. And there was some avowed white nationalists who were protesting to keep that monument. And it sort of just set off a ripple of these similar protests over these monuments all over the country.
Yeah, not as fiery here in Florida, thankfully. There was a similar incident in Tampa with a 1911 memorial at the entrance to the county courthouse, downtown Tampa. And one of the county commissioners had complained about this, kind of started the ball rolling on it. And his fellow county commissioners hemmed and hawed. And finally, they issued a challenge. If people out there can raise enough money to move the statue, we'll do it. Well, lo and behold, the very next day, they raised so much money, they had smashed this goal. People like Tony Dungy, you know, very famous African-American coach of the Bucks, personally chipped in a couple of thousand dollars, and they got the statue moved to a family cemetery in Brandon.
I've been sort of proud of Florida in this moment because it's a very emotional issue, but we seem to have, we let people speak or protest at town hall meetings and at city council meetings. People use their time, got up, had their say, and city governments seem to have found compromises. Now, of course, not everybody is going to be happy, probably on either side, but it's the way democracy is supposed to work.
And Robin, there's actually some statewide implications here. There's a Confederate general that the state of Florida has in the National Statuary Hall, which every state gets two statues in the National Statuary Hall, which is actually in Congress, and it's supposed to be famous people to represent your state. There's a Confederate general that Florida put up there, who knows, like 100
Kirby
years.
Kirby Smith.
Yeah, and I think he's been there for almost 100 years or something like that. And nobody really knows who he is, and there was a movement to take him out, and it actually seemed like a very civil process, and they agreed that you know, he should be removed. He didn't even have that strong of a connection to Florida. He left Florida as a young man, I think, and didn't come back. And so they're actually going to replace him. There's a bill moving through the state legislature, most likely going to pass in the 2018 session, that would replace him with Mary Bethune Cookman, who is a civil rights leader.
Bethune Cookman College.
Yeah,
we've
exactly.
All heard of. Yeah.
All right. Here's a trivia question for you. Do you know who the other statue is of?
John Gorey,
yes,
considered the founder of air conditioning, which right. Florida wouldn't exist in its modern state if it wasn't for him.
The
so he probably should stay.
Somebody, everybody can agree on it.
All right. We can't talk about the big news stories of the year without mentioning poor Snooty. Snooty was the manatee for years and years and years has been at the South Florida Museum in Bradenton and tragically died in an accident. Zach, what was that like?
Yeah, Robin, this was one of the worst stories. I mean, just an awful thing for the community. Snooty was an icon. he died in a tragic accident. He was 69 years old, I think the oldest living manatee in captivity, and probably the oldest living manatee on the planet because they live longer in captivity than in the wild. And he was just really beloved. Generations of school children would go on field trips to see him. My editor, you know, I believe went when he was a young boy, you know, years and years ago. Every year his birthday was a big celebration. Kids would make birthday cards for him and he would have a special birthday meal. His death was even worse because it was preventable. There was a door underneath his enclosure and it got loose and came ajar, and he kind of wedged himself into this really tight space and ended up drowning. You know, manatees need to surface for air. They're mammals. And so I know they looked into what happened, and I believe there were some changes made in an investigation.
They
done.
Said they checked that door. It just sounded like a terrible accident. Everyone was heartbroken.
It was really sad, and it was just sad for the community. You know, I was looking forward to taking my daughters to see Snooty someday, and that won't happen now.
So what are you looking forward to in the coming year? Any stories that jump out at you with the big stories coming up in the coming months?
All right. Well, first of all, I'm an environmental reporter, so that's kind of my milieu. There has been a push for several years to get more money for land preservation. Voters approved in 2014 Amendment 1, which would have mandated one-third of all the dock stamps, the taxes on land transactions to be used for land preservation. Never happened. The legislature basically said, yeah, I know the voters passed that as a constitutional amendment, but we don't care. So finally, 3 years later, there's a move to set some money aside. Governor Scott, who has eyes on higher office most likely, has proposed $50 million a year to be put into Florida Forever, the state's main land conservation program. And Senator Rob Bradley out of Fleming Island has doubled that, $100 million. So there's good news on the horizon, most likely, for people who'd like to see some of natural Florida saved before it's too late.
All right. And Zach?
Well, I'm the political editor at the paper, so I really focus on that. And from a political perspective, there's always a lot going on. But next year is a big year. It's a big test of Donald Trump's presidency and, how much of a pushback there is to that in the state and local
midterm elections.
Yeah, the midterm elections. I think this is one of the more anticipated midterm elections since I've been covering politics. So it'll be fascinating to see what happens here. We've seen some of the lead up to this where, you know, races in Alabama and Virginia where the Democrats have shown some pretty strong, results. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in Florida. You have a governor's race. You have all the cabinet positions open. Congressional races. There's some very interesting congressional races. And then all the way down through the state legislature and down to the local office. So it'll be a busy year.
Good time to be a political editor, Zach.
Exactly.
I want to thank WUSF Steve Newborn and Zach Anderson of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Thank you both so much for being
here. It was a pleasure.
Here.
Thanks, Rob.
And I want to introduce you to a new podcast from WUSF, Florida Matters More. If you like more good stories about our state from the producers of Florida Matters, you'll want to check it out. Just search for Florida Matters More on your podcast app or on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Got a new story that we missed? Tweet us at Florida Matters. And if you missed any of today's show, you can always find it online at WUSFnews.org. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. The producer is Stephanie Colombini, and the engineer is Richard Jimenez. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.